accession number 16808, reel 17.
Regspittles, reel 17.
Yeah, so we looked across the valley up to the ridge, like you say, and of course, there are no crumbles. I had all gone, you see, obviously pulled out, so I thought, well, that's tated it. What do we do now? So anyway, we motored round up the, started going up the side of the high embankment, you see, because we knew it would peter out. And
yeah, so after having been set up and fully equipped again from the 7th Armoured Div, the thing was to rejoin the regiment. Well, of course, as I say, when we started looking round, we found that they'd been obviously been withdrawn, so there were no signs of any Cromwells. And it was getting evening time, it was sort of 9, getting on for 10 o'clock. So not really knowing what to do for the best, I thought, well, I better motor around and try and find somebody. And we went up the valley along the railway embankment, and we came across our brigade HQ. And I parked up there, I went and found the brigade major and explained who I was and what had happened. And he said, well, the other thing is, he said, you better stay here for the night. So he said, in the morning, he said, come and see me and I'll tell you where your regiment's been parked up. So I said, right, sir. So, of course, we got some food on and one thing or another and settled down for the night, and which we were pleased about, because I mean, it was the first restful period we'd had for several days. And in the morning, I went and seen him, and he gave me their map reference where they were. In actual fact, as soon as we moved back across the railway line, we went about a mile, and of course we could see them all loaded up, you see. Anyway, we rejoined the regiment, and this was on the 20th of July. Well, the weather broke at that time, and all that day it poured rain, literally poured rain. And the normal thing was, when we used to pull out of an action, if it was in an area where the infantry had been, there was all dugouts that you could sort of get in without having to dig a hole to get under your tank yourself, you see. And of course they were all full of water, so the next best thing was to get into some of the lorries, because if you've got to stop in the tank and it's raining, well, you do so, but they're not very good for keeping water out, and they're miserable. You get dribblets of water coming in just when you don't expect it and all that sort of thing. So what you do, you get into the lorries. So we did the same, we piled into one of the lorries, and the fact that it turned out to be an ammunition lorry wasn't bothered us at all, because we're in a state then where you sort of think, well, if you're going to get killed, you're going to get killed, and you're a bit sort of philosophical about it, so by then. So we settled down for the night, and then a German plane came over and dropped some flares. Well, after about probably half an hour, getting on for an hour, we started getting an income of artillery shells. I'll assume they were artillery shells, I don't think they were planes bombing. And so Air Sergeant Bill Prosser, the echelon sergeant, he was an old desert rat, he was, and he was one of the chaps that they put into us while I was in Yorkshire to sort of, I don't know, as they stiffened us up, I think it was just so that we could talk to them and get some experience of what fighting was all about before we actually did any. At least that's the way I saw it. And he was an old chap, old Bill, and sort of a fatherly sort, being, as I thought, a bit older than me, and his outlook on life, having been out in the desert, I don't know how long, he sort of had a steadier approach to life, you know, he sort of, as I say, fatherly. Anyway, I heard him coming round, and he was shouting, everybody out, everybody out, banging on the canvas the sheets on the lorries with his stick. Of course, we all piled out, and it was pouring rain still. And of course, we got the camouflage nets and things around the lorries. Well, I did what you usually do when you wake up in the middle of the night. I needed to have a jimmy. So I'm leaning against the lorry with my forearm and my head resting on my forearm, peering back over my right shoulder, because about 400 yards away was a lorry that had been hit and it was on fire. And I thought, well, if that's an ammunition lorry and that blows up, not too far away, really. Anyway, it was an ammunition lorry, and it turned out to be an ammunition lorry for 25 pounders.
And when it went up, it went up a quarter bang and stuff went everywhere. And I dimly sort of remember hearing this noise, and it was obviously a bit of rubbish coming off of this lorry, and not being a particularly proper shaped object, it was sort of fluttering through the air, and I could hear it sort of going as it came. And then the next second, someone hit me in the ribs, and I was found myself on the floor, conscious of course, and couldn't get my breath. And the experience was like when you were kids at school and you used to get scuffling about, you used to try to punch each other in the ribs, and it used to take your breath away. You couldn't get your breath, and you'd be gasping, choking for wind, and you go and I'm choking away there on the floor, pouring around, thinking, now what damage has been done? I didn't know if I'd been wounded or what had happened. I knew I was on the floor still conscious, and anyway, everything settled down. The bombardment stopped. The only thing left was this lorry burning, and then I could hear old Bill Prosser shouting out, anybody been hit? And I heard a voice say, somebody over here, cop somebody, I think, Sarge. Anyway, the next thing I know, they found me. And, of course, up come the MO and his half-track, and they bundled me in the half-track. And, of course, consequently, I went into hospital. Now, at that time, they were doing the best, local regimental medical officers were doing the best to keep crews with the regiment, because tank crews were becoming very scarce, tank commanders in particular, which I was, you see. And they were reluctant to let you go to hospital in case they shipped your shape back to England, which, of course, there was always a chance you may not come back. So if they could keep you there, so much the better. So that had been the intention of our medical officer, who, my crew, the three of us in the turret who were all wounded, but he considered it was not a serious nature and something he could deal with, knowing also that we were not likely to go in action for possibly 10 days or 11 days. He felt, well, that would be sufficient time for him to get us ready, reasonably fit to go back in action again. So therefore, we would not be lost to the squadron. Well, anyway, this obviously put me into a hospital. So, and the strange thing was that these hospitals, at least this one was, it was at a marquee. And what they'd done, they dug a big hole out in the ground, put the marquee in it, so the walls of the marquee were below the ground level and just the top was above ground level. The soil that they'd dug out to make the hole, they'd piled round as a sort of a blast-proof thing. And the beds consisted of the stretchers with palliasses on, straw palliass, and blocks of wood underneath to keep you above off the ground, sort of a block at either end of the stretcher, probably about 18 inches to 2 feet, block of wood, at least that's what, as I recollect it. And so that's what the beds consisted of. And naturally, they were generally speaking for short-term wounds. They were not sort of critically ill wounds, but they were there for sort of first observations. Anyway, I went in there and they popped me into one of these beds. And it was funny, really, because after a couple of days, the nurse, they were all officers, actually, the nurses, but they were nurses, and they wore a sort of a grey-green uniform. But they had male orderlies, and they also had male doctors. And these girls used to come round, we called them nurses, but what the ranks were, I don't know. They seemed to run the hospital, and then the doctors only came round sort of once a day to just check on the, I suppose, the reports that they put in. Anyway, after a couple of days, where they'd basically sorted out what my situation was, they came round, and it was a routine, you see. Every day, these sisters would come round, and they'd go along, and of course, in the hospital, you'd have your clip on the end of your bed, but they used to come round with them in the hand, you see. So when they got to you, they'd take the clip and confirm that it was you. She said, "Ah, Corporal Spittles." I said, that's right, sister. She said, "No." She said, "I think you're going to be lucky." So I said, "Oh, thank you." She said, "I think you'll be going down the strip." Well, the strip consisted of a flight back to England, either by plane, or they took you from the strip down to the beach,
and you went back by boat. And I suppose it depended on the seriousness of your condition, whether they flew you back quick or whether you took sort of 24 hours on a boat. But anyway, she said, I think you're going to be lucky. So I said, oh yes. She said, I think you're going down the strip. I said, oh, thank you very much. So she said, I'll put a label on you. And they used to put a tag on you, see, on the bed. And that donated that you was going to be evacuated down the strip and go back to England. So I thought, well, that'd be nice, you know. At the same time, there's always a reluctancy to leave your regiment. It's like leaving a family, you see, especially if you don't have to go back to them. And anyway, the immediate thought was going back to England, you see. Done a little bit of fighting and thought, well, I'm due for a rest. So she carries on round the ward, as they called it. And eventually the doctor came, you see, and he then goes through the whole process again with the sister. Goes to each bed, she hands him the clip, he looks at it, confirms that it's the person who's in the bed, checks out what it is, and then carries on to the next one. Probably having a word if you're wounded, and like the doctor does, how do you feel today, you know, and all that sort of stuff, like they do in a general hospital. And when he gets to me, he says, Corporal Spittles? I said, yes, sir. He said, are you sure about this, sister? She said, what? He said, about the strip. She said, well, yes, she said. And they sort of discussed it. Anyway, he said, oh, all right then. So he left it, you see, as though I was going to go back. And they carried on down two or three more beds. And they'd gone about three beds down from me. And they stopped, and I was having a little bit of a hubbub. And he walked back gently. He said, Corporal, I said, yes, sir. He said, down here, they got you down as a driver mechanic. I said, quite right, sir, I'm a driver mechanic by trade. I said, a class two, sir. Yes, he said, but you're not a driver mechanic, are you? I said, I don't quite follow that, sir. I said, it's in my pay book. I get a trade pay for it. I know that, he said, but what I mean is, you're not a driver. I said, no, sir, I'm a tank commander. He said, that's, there you are, you see, sister, he said, that's it, he said. These people have got to go back. He said, so I'm sorry, Corporal, he said, you won't be going down the strip. And they took me tag off. So I thought, that's a bit of bad luck. Anyway, so they carried on down, and that was that incident gone, you see. And we had incidents happen while I was in there. I was in there for about 7 days. And we had incidents happen. We had one chap, and you appreciate by now that I landed on D10. Well, you imagine that all credit goes to the people that landed on D-Day. So you take D-Day, and you are a hero. Now, if you're a D1, you're not quite so much of a hero. And as it progresses from D1 to 2 to 3 to 4, so you lessen in what you might call being a hero. So when you get to D10 like me, then of course you're just anybody, you're just filling in. But we've got a chap in there who had not been wounded severely, but he got a lot of multiple wounds, not enough to make him a bed patient, and so he spent his time walking about all the time and generally helping the staff and one thing or another, and talking to everybody, helping take cups of tea around and stuff like that. And he was stripped of the waist because he'd got patches all over him. And he was a nice, likeable chap, but he did like to tell the new people that he was a D-Day man. Because you appreciate that by now, all these casualties, anybody who was a casualty at that time who landed on D-Day were very, very scarce. And so he was the only one in the ward who landed on D-Day. And so after a reasonable period, he made it a point of approaching you and talking to you. And then he'd get round to the point and say, of course, I landed on D-Day. You see, with great emphasis on the fact that he landed on D-Day. So in the next bed to me was a sergeant major from the Welsh regiment, the Welsh division, named Smith. Now, strangely enough, I met a friend of mine whose brother had been also a sergeant major in the Welsh, and unfortunately he was able to tell me that this sergeant major was killed later after he was returned to the unit. He was in there because he got a lump of shrapnel in his back, which they decided wasn't sufficient to send him back to England, and they were dealing with it in the hospital. And then after a few days or whatever, he was returned to his unit, as the same as what I was. But anyway, he was in the next bed to me, and after we got chatting and talking, we found we had a bit of common bond in a sort of character aptitude, and we were getting on, and he said, that bloke, he said, that D-Day bloke, he said, he's a bloody nuisance, he said. He comes round, he said, bombing his load about landing on bloody D-Day. All right, he said, so it was a bloody tricky thing, he said, but after all, he said, it's bloody gone now, isn't it, you know. So I said, yeah. Anyway, I said, I'll stop him when he comes round. I said, because he'll have me eventually. So eventually he did. He came to me and he said, talking, he said, and eventually he said, when did you land there, mate? I said, D10. Oh, he said, oh, D-Day me, you know. I said, yes, yeah, so I gathered. I said, you were lucky, weren't you? He said, lucky? I have nothing lucky about landing on D-Day, mate. He said, we're bloody rough. I said, yeah, but I mean, when you look at it seriously, you were lucky. What are you talking about? He said, well, I said, look, when you landed, I said, the Jebbies was the last thing I expected. It was rough weather. I said, and even Rommel had gone home on holiday. I said, and then you lot land. I said, biggest surprise of their lives. I said, it took them 12 hours to get over the shock before they started firing at you. I said, me? I landed on D-10. So when I landed, they were bloody angry, I tell you. He said, this bloke said, don't talk bloody daft, he said. But he never come down to me again, and I never spoke to me anymore. But this sergeant major laughed. He said, he didn't expect that bugger, did he? I said, no, I said, but you have to give him credit, don't you? You know, anybody who landed on D-Day, they have to have credit. But then we went on from there, and I was discharged from there, eventually, after about 7 days. And on my report, which I've still got it tucked away in my bits and my papers and things, that they recommended 14 days light duties when I returned to the regiment. However, they thought anybody could have 14 days light duties in Normandy at that time, I don't know. But anyway, you go through a procedure to get back to your regiment. You don't go straight in a truck and go straight back to your regiment. They have a system. And you go to a holding unit. Well, then you go from that one to another one. And in my case, I went to one holding unit, and then a second holding unit, and then I went to the tank delivery squadron. And those are the people that sort of, in between the fighting regiments and the beachheads, these people are responsible for bringing up vehicles from the base up to the fighting line for the fighting units, you say. Whatever the vehicles are, they could be wheel vehicles, but it doesn't matter what it is. They deliver these vehicles, the delivery squadrons, you see. And their drivers normally deliver the vehicle, they get in a lorry and they return to the squadron. They are permanent staff. It is a squadron in its own right, you see. And so I finished up with this squadron. Anyway, I did have a bit of luck in a way, because when I got this first trip from the first holding unit to the second one, which basically were only bell tents in a field, and a sergeant in the first one with a register checking your progress of movement from point A to point B. So at all times, the army know where you are. And when I got in this 1500 weight truck the following morning to go to the second holding unit, a boy said, oh, God blimey, Red Spills. And it turned out to be a friend, a TA friend of mine who lived at Blizworth. And his name was Dennis Ward. Well, he left us as a sergeant. He went to Octune and became an officer. And he went out to the desert and all that sort of thing. And I bumped into him. And he was in one of the regular Royal Tank regiments. I don't know which one it was, but he was in one of them. And he was a lieutenant. Now, there's a funny sequel to this story, which I might as well tell you now. Later on, after the... I was downgraded than that. I'd been on a leave, on my first leave to England, and I was returning, and the thing was that although you was taken down to go on your leave, when you came back, you was left to your own discretion of how to get back to your unit, hitchhiking, you see. And I finished up at this time in some barracks or other up in Germany. I was waiting to get a lift for about the last 30 miles to where I was stationed. And we used to spend the time standing at the gate. It was in the winter, freezing cold, snow. And you'd stand there, and as lorries came out or vehicles came out, you'd say, you going anywhere near so-and-so, mate? And if he was, he'd say, yeah, jump in, and he'd give you a lift, you see, and that way you hitchhike back to your unit. At this time, I was doing that sort of thing. I'd spend half an hour at the gate, and when you get cold, you go back inside again, you see, and get warm, and have another session. And I was standing there, and this Jeep pulled up, you see, with this officer sitting in it, and a corporal driving it. And I noticed that he was all huddled up, you see, and I noticed he got his beret on, and I really couldn't see his face, but I noticed he got a crown on his shoulder, you see. And as he come up, I just put my hand up, and he stopped. And before I could say anything, he said, well, bugger me, he said, it's been a bloody long time, he said, but how are you, Reg? And it turned out to be the same one, Tush Ward, as we call it. That was his nickname, Tush. Dennis Ward lived at Blisworth, and he was now a major. From the last time I saw him in Normandy, he was a lieutenant. So obviously through the casualties, you get this rapid promotion, you see. And by now, he was a squadron leader with a crown up on his pips. And I said, well, God blimey, fancy meeting you again, Tush, I said. So he said, hey, hang on, what do you think this is on my shoulder? So I said, yeah, what do you think these are on my arm? So he said, yeah, all right, he said. But yes, he's gone from a lieutenant to a major by the time he was up in Germany. But anyway, reverting back to the proper story. So we had a bit of a chat in the back of this truck until we got to the next holding unit where we were tipped out, and we separated, and I never saw him again until that other incident. And then I went to this tank delivery squadron and reported in. There was a captain in charge of it. And like the medical officer, when you report in, they look at your pay book. And in my pay book, I'm the driver mechanic. So he said, oh, good. He said, I'm short of drivers. He said, I've got blokes out. He said, it ain't been returned yet. He said, so go find somewhere to put your kit down. He said, you better find yourself a mate. He said, because I've got nowhere to put you. I've got no spare tent or nothing. So he said, you'll have to use your ground sheet. Well, these army ground sheets that we had issued were a double purpose thing. Apart from keeping you warm, they were oblong in shape, and they used to have a triangular piece as part of it at one end. And people think, well, that's to make it like a cape, so you could pull it round, and it had metal buttons on it. And the object of it was that two of these ground sheets made a little bivy, because the buttons and the holes corresponded with another one. So if you had two of these ground sheets, you made a little tent, because either the little triangular piece on the end of each one created the flap at both ends of a tent. So you had a little bivy, and because you got two ground sheets, there was room for two men to sleep. So he said, you better get yourself a mate, he said, and you got your ground sheet? I said, yes, sir. So I was shacked up with another bloke, and he was at the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment, as it happened. He got the military medal. Little tubby chap, and I don't like to keep diverting, but I might forget these little stories if I don't. The strange thing was that we made this bivy in this thing, and years and years after the war, one of our niece's daughters had a hole in her heart, and she had to go to Oxford to have an operation. Well, her father asked me if I'd go for companionship with him. He felt a bit dodgy about taking his daughter. So I said, I'll go with you, Barry. So we went over to Oxford. And of course, if anyone knows, when you go to the Radford Hospital in Oxford, there's literally nowhere to park in any of the streets or anywhere, especially at the hospital. So he said, Christ, he said, what do we do about it? And of course, there was, at that time, there was none of this parking and ride in. It was simply find somewhere to park your car. So I said, well, let's go to the hospital first, I said, and get Louise off our hands if necessary, and then find somewhere to park the car afterwards. So we drove in, and the only spaces vacant were doctors or surgeons or some official who hadn't turned up or wasn't coming in that day. But they'd got names on the square, so they were vacant. So I said, well, there's some vacant spots, I said. But I said, well, anyway, I said, let's go and have a word at the door with the commissionaire, because they got an office, you see, and a chappy in there. And I went in, and Barry came in with me. Like, as soon as I saw this chap, I thought, I've met you before. And he said, yes, what can I do? So I said, well, we're trying to find somewhere to park the car. I said, you know, he said, no chance, mate. He said, cool, he said, I don't know what to tell you. So I said, can't help us then. No, he said, I'm sorry.
He said, you just had a, well, draw round, he said, more or less. I said, oh, right. I said, but all right, I met you before. He said, have you? I said, yeah. I said, trying to think where it was. I said, you weren't in the third tanks, were you? He said, yeah, I was. I said, you got the MM? He said, that's right. I said, you and me shared a couple of ground sheets in Normandy, in the tank delivery squadron. Oh, God blimey, he said, fancy you turning up like that. It was him, the same chap that we shared two ground sheets, and he turned up. He was only in the office at Oxford at the Ratcliffe. So I said, well, hey, nice to meet you again. I said, well, nice to know you got through. He said, and you, mate, he said. So could never got to know names, you see, not because you forgot anyway. So I said, anyway, I said, what about this parking? He said, well, look, Mr. So-and-so, he won't be in today. Put it in there, he said. That'll be all right. So it's a funny thing how life goes a full circle. Anyway, I get to the delivery and we sort out. Me and this chap get down for the night, you see. And the next morning, I get sort of reports to the office, and this young captain, he says, right. And he said, right, innit? We all got in a truck, and they took us down to the beach. And I drove up a Sherman. It's the only time I've ever been in a Sherman. And I drove up an M10 tank destroyer, which is more or less the same as driving a Sherman, because the controls are the same. It's just a different shaped vehicle. And funny, the system they had was most peculiar, because I would have thought that when these tanks came over from England, they would have been equipped ready to go in action. But what happened was, you drove it up from the beach, nobody in the turret, you just drove up following somebody else, and then they've got a system of about 5 points around this area. You drove to the first one, and they took everything off the tank, all the equipment. You went to the next point, and they put so much equipment back on. And you went to the next point, and they put some more equipment on. And when you got round to the fifth one, you were fully equipped for everything that the crew would need in action, but it had created a surplus of requirement, which God knows where that went. But then you parked the vehicle ready for wherever it got to go, you see, and then reported back to the office that you were now available again. And so, as I say, the second vehicle I fetched up was an M10 tank destroyer, and we, same procedure, we drove up, I took everything off, went to point one, put some back on. Next point, put some more back on. When you got to the fifth point, it was ready. So you went and parked it and reported back to the office. Well, because that took all day to do that with two vehicles. And so we got down that night, and suddenly somebody comes round, because you always have a runner, you see, at the office. And this runner came round, shared tonight, Corporal Spittles, NY, 2NY. So I stuck me, I said, over here. Right, he said, get your kit, report the office straight away. He said, I've got a tank for you. So I gathers my kit up, says cheerio to this chap from the third tanks. And I left my grain sheet with him, otherwise you wouldn't have had a tent, you see. So I knew I'd get another grain sheet, so it didn't matter. So I gathered my kit up and reported up there. And they got some Cromwells, you see. And they formed up a convoy of all mixed vehicles, more or less in the order of sequence, so they would drop off the first one, then carry on to the next unit and drop off some more vehicles, on to the next unit, drop off some, till there was no vehicles left. And as each drivers of these vehicles were delivered the vehicles, they got in the lorry which was following, so that the lorry eventually went back with the drivers to the holding squadron, you see, having delivered all these vehicles to the various units. So I collected a Cromwell, a brand new one, you see. Didn't need anybody in the turret, because all I did was follow the vehicle in front, who went, and the column went from one unit to another unit to another unit, each time dropping off the vehicles that that unit was expecting to receive. Well, I gets back to the 2NY and takes it to my squadron, and Bill Bailey, who was the technical storeman, he was a corporal. And he, to me, seemed to be doing the work the Sergeant Major ought to have been doing. But anyway, he was in charge of the thing, like, you see. So, of course, I drive this tank up. Bill comes across to look at it, and I climb out, and he says, Ah, and he was an old TA man from, like, you know, and he used to work in a bank. So probably they had a memory for figures. And it was amazing because amongst us old blokes from the TA days, he never forgot your army number, you see. And as soon as he saw one of you, his gimmick used to be, ah, and he said, Corporal Spittle, 7892098, you see, straight away, quick as a flash. So I said, yeah, that's me, Bill. So he said, right. He said, well, you're lucky. So I said, oh, am I? Thought I won the pools or something, you see. So he said, you can have your crew back. Well, naturally, when I rejoined with a new tank, I was thinking that I would not see my crew, my original crew, again, you see. They would fix me up with the crew for the tank. But it was unlikely to be my old crew because they would have been made use of while I was away, you see. Now, I arrived back during the night of the 29th of July. Now,